Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, March 11th. We have an opportunity to speak for about 10 minutes now with a U.S. State Department official on U.S. policy toward the war in Ukraine. He is Derek Chollet, whose title is Counselor or Undersecretary of State. He served in the Obama administration, too, as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, where he managed U.S. defense policy toward Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and the Western Hemisphere. He was last on this show in 2016 to talk about President Obama's foreign policy legacy, and he is co-author of a book that came out back in 2008, but is actually very relevant right now, about the period after the Cold War ended, called America Between the Wars, from 11-9, which is a Berlin Wall falling reference, 11-9 to 9-11. Secretary Chollet, thank you for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be back with you. Thanks so much.
And since we have just 10 minutes, I'll dive right in on the hard parts, okay?
Sure, sounds great.
Yesterday's show, we had Slate Magazine's military affairs columnist, Fred Kaplan, who wrote an article outlining a potential peace agreement to end the war when both sides are exhausted enough to be ready. If you know Fred's work, you know he is not at all a Putin apologist. His goal, he says, is to allow Putin to save face by declaring victory while not actually giving him anything. So it involves recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea from 2014, because we're not reversing it anyway, and the people there seem mostly okay with it, he said. It involves setting up a referendum in the eastern areas with the pro-Russia separatists, let people vote whether to stay in Ukraine, supervised by the UN, so it's a real election, and agree that Ukraine will not join NATO, which he says doesn't stop Ukraine from forming military alliances with the United States or anyone else separately. In exchange, of course, Russia has to pull back all its troops, and there we go. So could that be a good deal diplomatically, in your opinion, to end the bloodshed?
Well, look, first, thanks again for having me on. There's no shortage of ideas of how we might use diplomacy to end this completely unjustified, unwarranted, but premeditated war. And the United States, Secretary of State Blinken, my boss, worked tirelessly in the months leading up to this conflict that started 16 days ago to try to find a diplomatic way forward and to show Russia that there was a path for diplomacy. While making very clear at the same time that if they chose the other path, if they chose the path of invasion and confrontation and escalation, that they would face swift and severe consequences. Unfortunately, they chose that latter path. And therefore, what we've watched unfold the last 16 days, which we had been quite worried about for some time prior to the invasion, as we've watched evidence of Russia's buildup grow, we are watching the devastation of Ukraine. It's completely unacceptable what is happening, and Russia has to pay a very, very high price. Now, just yesterday you had Fred Kaplan on, but at the same time, the Ukrainian foreign minister was sitting down in Turkey to meet with the Russian foreign minister, and the Russians and the Ukrainians have had several other conversations over the last 16 days. Unfortunately, there is no evidence to suggest that the Russian side is interested in much of anything beyond the complete subjugation of Ukraine. And therefore, Putin seems intent on continuing this violent course that he is on. And the
what's been offered? What's been offered diplomatically?
Well, so again, this is the Ukrainians' negotiation here. So I can't speak to what they're talking about. But I think what's quite clear is that Russia cannot be allowed to be rewarded for what is, again, an unwarranted, unprovoked attack on a sovereign country. I mean, this is going at the very heart of the international system itself. The idea that states can choose their own destiny and would not be, you know, weaker states do not get gobbled up by larger, stronger states. And that is what we see Russia attempting to do right now.
Right. And as it stands, Putin is just bombarding Ukrainian city after Ukrainian city and committing war crime after war crime against civilians. But there's no structure for him to back down without total defeat, which could mean this goes on for years. So for you as a State Department official, the State Department does diplomacy, Pentagon does the war. Do you have anything in the works?
Well, again, I mean, Russia could choose to end its invasion of Ukraine. It could withdraw its troops. It could allow, obviously, it's going to have to sign up now for helping to rebuild a Ukraine once this war ends. And for the United States, what we're doing now is doing everything in our power to support the Ukrainians whose bravery, whose patriotism, whose resilience is awe-inspiring to all of us. And we are doing whatever we can to help them, whether that's in terms of security assistance or humanitarian needs.
Well, from the and I'm going to jump in just because of our time constraints, but from the Ukrainian perspective, and to flip the script from what I was asking you before, the U.S. is not doing all it can. Ukrainians want a no-fly zone over all or parts of Ukraine, and for us to allow Polish MiG fighters to fly to Ukraine from the U.S. NATO air base in Ramstein, Germany, the U.S. is saying no to both of those because they make the U.S. a party to the war. I'm going to ask you to play that out for us. What do you think that would precipitate that would be worse than the murderous status quo?
Well, what we are looking to do is do everything in our power to support Ukraine while at the same time not start a wider war in Europe, and in particularly a conflict between NATO and Russia. President Biden has been very clear. The United States will defend every inch of NATO territory. And we will do everything in our power to support Ukraine. We provided just this year over $1 billion of security assistance. Actually, in the last 16 days, we provided over $250 million of security assistance to Ukraine, and that's anti-armor, anti-tank weaponry, it's shoulder-fired air defense. And that's not just the United States, by the way. It's the United States working with 14 other countries, at least, to provide assistance.
So we're arming them a lot, which maybe is in its way being a party to the war. But what do you think would happen if we took President Zelensky's request and enforced what he, at least what he calls a humanitarian no-fly zone, where the corridors are that supposedly Russia is letting people leave through, but it isn't really. I mean, nobody wants a wider war, but do you think if we're in there with planes or Polish planes that we help leave, enforcing a no-fly zone, does that mean Putin's going to attack Poland? Does that mean he's going to attack NATO nations? Why wouldn't that be suicide for him?
Well, he's been very clear that, A, he's willing to take tremendous risks to achieve his goals. Again, we are need to stay very focused on not creating a wider war here, while at the same time doing everything we can to support Ukraine. A no-fly zone, which we have experience doing, and whether it's in Libya in particular or in the Balkans back 20-some years ago, that is war. That is U.S. planes enforcing a no-fly zone, prepared to take out enemy planes and also to take out enemy air defense, wherever that air defense may be. And in Ukraine's case, Russian air defenses over Ukraine exist in Russia. So, you know, a no-fly zone is a euphemism for something that is direct combat. Now, there is a threat from the air to Ukraine, and that can be addressed, we believe, by air defense systems for Ukraine. And that's what we have been working very hard to provide them. They've got a significant amount of them from us already, but we are working to provide more, including with partners who have systems that they can operate. So, because the other issue is, these air defense assets aren't like Amazon Prime, where you can just get them on a moment's notice to your doorstep. It takes a while to get them there. And then, of course, there's so many systems they need to get trained on. So we need to get them systems that they know how to operate right now, because they don't have the time to get trained.
We have just a couple of minutes left with U.S. Undersecretary of State Derek Chollet. And you'll tell me when we're actually out of time. I'm going to try to get two more questions in here.
I got time. It's great to be with you. So I got time.
Thank you. Well, one is of historical interest, and then I want to ask you about China. Mm-hmm. You wrote, I was looking you up this morning and reading an article that you wrote on the Brookings Institution website in 2001, before 9/11. And you wrote, The real point of the NATO alliance in the 21st century is what we can do together outside of Europe. That's why the United States pushed its allies before NATO's 50th anniversary summit in 1999 to agree to a role for NATO beyond Europe. The Europeans refused. So that was from you in 2001. My question is, why shouldn't my listeners think that it was exactly this kind of U.S. expansionism after the Cold War that fed Putin's paranoid nationalism and set the stage for this horror we're seeing today?
Well, again, to be clear, NATO is a defensive alliance. It's an alliance that countries on their own choose to join. And it's telling, and listeners should ask themselves, why is it that so many countries at the end of the Cold War were asking to join NATO and willing to take very, very serious steps in terms of reform and their military capabilities to be eligible to join NATO, which required a lot of money and sacrifice. There's a reason why many of those countries wanted to join, in part because they were so worried about Russia. But we've been very clear that NATO is a defensive alliance. NATO has shown, whether it was the Balkans 25 years ago or NATO's operations in Afghanistan in the 20 years after 9/11, that it can work out of area. But fundamentally, it is about protecting NATO allies from external threats. And that's the basic purpose of NATO. What we're seeing in Ukraine, by the way, it's quite clear. And if you listen to Putin's speeches, if you see what he's doing, this is not about NATO. This is about Putin's desire to subjugate and control Ukraine. And everyone should remember, this actually started 8 years ago when they had the Maidan protests in Kyiv that led to the overthrow, the removal of a Putin stooge and a democratic government taking office in Kyiv. And that was about, those protests were about Ukraine's relationship with the EU, the European Union. It wasn't about NATO. So I mean, what Putin wants is a sphere of influence. He wants to be able to control and subjugate Ukraine. He's using NATO as a convenient excuse to try to shift the blame to someone else. But I think it's quite clear what his motives are.
So last thing about China. They were neutral in the recent UN vote, meaning they didn't side with Russia like North Korea did, but they didn't side with the vast majority of the world either that was condemning the invasion. I saw a criticism by the head of the Council on Foreign Relations on MSNBC's Morning Joe today, criticism of U.S. policy alienating China when we should be cultivating them right now. So what are you doing? What is the government doing to cultivate China, seeing it in their interest not to circle the wagons with Putin?
We have been talking to the Chinese, as most other countries around the world, but we've been talking to the Chinese in particular in the last several months about the Ukraine crisis. Secretary of State Blinken spoke with the Chinese foreign minister once again just a few days ago about this crisis. And we're making very clear to China that Russia's actions are an assault on the international system. It's an international system that China itself is invested in. And that they need to, A, as much as possible and as much as they have any influence over Russia, to get Putin to change course and end this war and withdraw his troops. But that B, making very clear to them that if they were to take Russia's side or take steps to try to support Russia through this or try to evade our sanctions, that there would be consequences for China as well, that they would, if they involve themselves in sanctionable activity, they would be sanctioned. So, I think for China, this has put them in a very difficult position because, this war is not going well for Putin. This war is not going well for Russia. And China does not want to own this problem. So we are committed, though, to try to stay in very close touch with them, as we have through our engagements, to try to get them to be part of the solution here rather than compounding the problem.
And, of course, China is such a big market. If they join the sanctions, then it would put that much more pressure on Russia. Well, you're obviously not in an easy position there. The United States is in an easy position there, figuring out what to do next that can have any impact without widening the war. So Derek Chollet, Undersecretary of State at the U.S. State Department, thank you for giving us some time today. We hope you'll come back again.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it and look forward to coming back.
Brian Lehrer, A Daily Politics Podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.